Listening to VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, an unusually early heat wave in India has likely reduced the country's wheat harvest. That has left observers doubting that the country can meet its own needs while increasing crop exports to replace shortages caused by Russia's war in Ukraine. Recently, several large areas near India's capital, New Delhi, which are used for waste storage, have caught fire. The fires were blamed on the heat. Schools in eastern India shut down because of the heat. In the city of Rajgarh in central India, temperatures reached a record high 46.5 degrees Celsius. Temperatures reached 45 degrees Celsius in 9 other cities. But it was the heat in March that hurt crops. Wheat is easily affected by heat. Indian farmers time their planting so that the wheat ripens during India's cooler spring. But climate change has made India's temperatures rise, said Frederica Otto. She is a climate scientist at the Imperial College of London. She said that before human activity increased world temperatures, heat waves like this year's would have struck India once in 50 years. But now it is a much more common event. We can expect such high temperatures about once in every 4 years, she said. India's vulnerability to extreme heat increased 15% from 1990 to 2019. That information comes from a 2021 report by the British medical publication Lancet. India is among the top 5 countries where vulnerable people, like the old and the poor, have the highest exposure to heat. India and Brazil have the highest number of heat-related deaths in the world, the report said. Farm workers like Baldev Singh are among the most vulnerable. Singh is a farmer in northern India's Punjab state. He watched his crop dry up before his eyes as a usually cool spring changed to extreme heat. He lost about one-fifth of his crop. I am afraid the worst is yet to come, Singh said. Punjab is usually the biggest supplier to India's national crop reserves. The government had hoped to buy about one-third of this year's production from the area. But government officials predict lower production numbers this year. Agriculture policy expert Devinder Sharma said he expected to get 25% less wheat. The same is true in other major wheat-producing states like Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh. The Indian government purchased over 43 million metric tons of wheat in 2021. Sharma estimates it will instead get 20 to 50% less. India is the world's second largest producer of wheat, but the country exports only a small percentage of its harvest. India has been hoping to gain from the worldwide disruption of wheat supplies by Russia's war in Ukraine. Officials also want to develop new markets for Indian wheat in Europe, Africa, and Asia. India needs about 25 million tons of wheat for the large food welfare program that usually feeds more than 80 million people. Before the coronavirus, India had far more supplies than it needed. But Sharma said those reserves have been strained by the food welfare program. Officials provided free grain during the pandemic to about 800 million people. The program was extended until September. But it is unclear if the program will continue beyond that time.
British researchers say they have documented a case of a patient who had COVID-19 for 505 days. Experts say they think the case represents the longest infection of COVID-19 on record. The research was part of a study that looked at whether virus mutations can form in people who carry COVID-19 for a very long time. The study involved 9 patients who tested positive for the virus for at least 8 weeks. All patients had weakened immune systems linked to organ replacement operations, HIV, cancer, or other diseases. Repeated tests showed that the patient's infections lasted an average of 73 days. 2 of them had the virus longer than a year. Before the study, the longest known COVID-19 case was believed to have lasted 335 days. Dr. Luke Blagden-Snell helped lead the study. He told the Associated Press the researchers considered the cases studied to be persistent COVID-19. This is different from what has been described as long COVID-19. With long COVID-19, it is believed that the virus has been cleared from the patient's body, but individuals can still experience signs or symptoms of disease, Snell said. A persistent infection represents ongoing active replication of the virus, he added. Each time researchers tested patients, they examined the genetic code of the virus to make sure it was the same version or variant. Results from the study showed that the virus could change and mutate over time. Snell said the observed mutations were similar to ones that later showed up in widespread variants of COVID-19. But the team noted that none of the new mutations in the 9 cases became variants of concern. There was also no evidence that any of the patients had spread the virus to others. 5 of the 9 patients studied survived. 2 got rid of the infection without treatment. 2 cleared the infection after treatment, and 1 still has COVID-19. The person with the longest known infection tested positive in early 2020 and was treated with the drug remdesivir and died in 2021. The study team refused to name the exact cause of the patient's death. The researchers said the patient had other diseases along with COVID-19. Scientists hope to develop treatments to help people recover from persistent COVID-19 infections. We do need to be mindful that there are some people who are more susceptible to these problems, like persistent infection and severe disease, Snell said. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA, Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Jessica Damiano moved into a new home in the spring of 2005. At the time, the only plants growing in the garden were a rhododendron bush, a few daffodil flowers, and some ferns. A month later, she was delighted to see a flowering plant start to grow. She did not know the name of the beautiful purple plant, but that did not matter to her. She loved it. 2 years later, Damiano graduated from Cornell University's Master Gardener program. She worked as a gardening writer for a local newspaper. That is when she found out the truth. She discovered that her favorite plant was called purple loosestrife, and that it was considered invasive in her home state of New York. However, she told herself that the plant was not spreading on the property and that it was not out of control. Then she learned more. Some plants known to be invasive are what Damiano calls wolves in sheep's clothing. This means they may seem harmless and well-contained in the garden, but become harmful in other places. Birds eat the seeds of invasive plants and spread them to other places. Those seeds grow into new plants that outgrow native plants. Damiano said this is because invasive plants often are not eaten by local wildlife, which would otherwise keep them under control. If not controlled, invasive plants grow larger and push out native plants that provide food and shelter for birds, insects, and small animals. This harms the local environment. Many state environmental agencies ban the sale and use of plants found to be harmful to human or ecological health. But some invasive plants are not officially considered invasive. Others may be listed as invasive in one area, but not another. And some invasive plants continue to be sold in stores. So, what is a gardener to do? Damiano says to avoid any plants sold as vigorous, fast-spreading, quick-climbing, or a rapid self-sower. She warns that these are all seller's code words for invasive plants. Next, learn about your local area. Which plants are invasive and which plants are native? Ask government agencies, universities and colleges, and environmental groups. You can also do your own research at libraries or online. In the end, Damiano says she pulled the purple loosestrife from her garden. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency warns that the plant clogs rivers and lakes. It also grows so thick that boats and swimmers can't get through. It also destroys food and habitat for fish and water birds. She replaced that plant with the native and equally beautiful blazing star plant. This plant has been growing happily without problems in her garden for the past 15 years. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton took office in January of 1993. During his 8 years as president, he appointed more women and minorities to the government than any president before him. He also appointed the second woman ever to serve on the Supreme Court. For the first 2 years of his presidency, Bill Clinton had a Congress controlled by members of his own party, the Democrats. Still, he failed in his efforts to pass legislation to reform the nation's health care system. During the presidential campaign, Bill Clinton had promised to help millions of Americans get health care coverage.
This health care system of ours is badly broken, and it is time to fix it. Despite the dedication of literally millions of talented health care professionals, our health care is too uncertain and too expensive, too bureaucratic and too wasteful. It has too much fraud and too much greed. We must make this our most urgent priority. Giving every American health security, health care that can never be taken away, health care that is always there.
He appointed his wife, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, to lead a committee to develop the plan. Critics argued that the plan would lead to socialized medicine. In the end, lawmakers decided that the plan would cost too much and would be too difficult to administer. But President Clinton found support on other issues, including crime-fighting legislation. The measure included money for hiring more police officers and building more prisons. Congress also passed his budgets for 1993 and 94 that reduced federal spending. But Clinton's relations with Congress became more difficult after the 1994 congressional elections. The fight over health care and other issues had only led to greater dissatisfaction with Washington. The elections were a big defeat for the Democrats in Congress.
A rising tide lifts all boats, so they say, and the Republicans are sailing right to victory in the House of Representatives, CNN estimating that the Republicans will take more than enough seats to take control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. And here's what's interesting. It is cutting across all regions. It is cutting across all ages. It is cutting across literally all the candidates.
CNN reporter Frank Cessno. Voters gave Republicans control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. President Clinton supported welfare reform to reduce spending on public assistance, but he blocked Republican efforts to cut what he believed was too much money from programs including health care for retirees and the poor. Budget fights with the Republican-led Congress resulted in two shutdowns of government operations.
The government is partially shutting down because Congress has failed to pass the straightforward legislation necessary to keep the government running without imposing sharp hikes in Medicare premiums and deep cuts in education and the environment. It is particularly unfortunate that the Republican Congress has brought us to this juncture because, after all, we share a central goal, balancing the federal budget. We must lift the burden of debt that threatens the future of our children and grandchildren. Unfortunately, Republican leaders in Washington have put ideology ahead of common sense and shared values.
The economy had suffered a recession during the previous administration of George H.W. Bush. After Bill Clinton became president, the economy grew slowly at first, but then recovered more quickly. 1 month into his presidency, Bill Clinton had to deal with a terrorist attack against the United States.
There's been an explosion deep below the 110-story towers of the World Trade Center in New York City.
On February 26, 1993, members of Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center in New York City. The terrorists left a truck loaded with explosives in an underground parking garage.
By early afternoon, Lower Manhattan looked like a war zone. Office workers, faces blackened with smoke and soot, hundreds gasping for breath, staggered into the frigid February air.
The attack killed six people and injured more than 1,000 others. The government later captured those responsible for the bombing. On April 19, 1995, terrorists again struck the United States. Only this time, it was a case of homegrown terrorism. The target was the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
It was an explosion blowing off the entire north face of that building.
The bombing killed 168 people. It was the deadliest terrorist attack ever on American soil up to that time. The man behind the attack was Timothy McVeigh, a former soldier who hated the government. He was captured soon after the explosion. McVeigh was tried and in 2001 executed for his crimes. A friend of his, another military veteran, was also involved in the plot and was sent to prison. President Clinton also had to deal with foreign and humanitarian crises.
A year ago, we all watched with horror as Somali children and their families lay dying by the tens of thousands, dying the slow, agonizing death of starvation. A starvation brought on not only by drought, but also by the anarchy that then prevailed in that country.
President Bush had sent American troops to Somalia in 1992 to assist the United Nations in feeding starving Somalis. Civil war was preventing the people from receiving aid during a drought. In October of 1993, 18 American soldiers were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. It happened during a failed raid on a hotel to search for a militia leader.
This past weekend, we all reacted with anger and horror as an armed Somali gang desecrated the bodies of our American soldiers and displayed a captured American pilot, all of them soldiers who were taking part in an international effort to end the starvation of the Somali people themselves. These tragic events raise hard questions about our effort in Somalia. Why are we still there? What are we trying to accomplish? How did a humanitarian mission turn violent? And when will our people come home? These questions deserve straight answers. Let's start by remembering why our troops went into Somalia in the first place. We went because only the United States could help stop one of the great human tragedies of this time. A third of a million people had died of starvation and disease. Twice that many more were at risk of dying. Meanwhile, tons of relief supplies piled up in the capital of Mogadishu because a small number of Somalis stopped food from reaching their own countrymen. Our troops created a secure environment so that food and medicine could get through. We saved close to 1 million lives.
and throughout most of Somalia, life began returning to normal. Nearly a million Somalis still depend completely on relief supplies, but at least the starvation is gone. And none of this would have happened without American leadership and America's troops. Let us demonstrate to the world, as generations of Americans have done before us, that when Americans take on a challenge, they do their job right.
But members of Congress demanded a withdrawal. A few days after the battle, President Clinton ordered American troops to leave Somalia within 6 months. In 1994, President Clinton sent troops to Haiti to return that country's first democratically elected leader to office. Military officers had overthrown President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 3 years earlier. That crisis led thousands of Haitian refugees to try to flee to the United States by boat. In 1995, American diplomatic efforts, as well as NATO airstrikes, helped produce a peace agreement to end the long and bloody civil war in Bosnia. President Clinton sent American peacekeeping troops to the former Yugoslav Republic. In November of 1993, Congress approved NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The agreement ended most import taxes between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It lowered barriers to the flow of goods, services, and investments. President Bush had signed the agreement with Mexico and Canada. American labor unions and environmental groups opposed NAFTA, but Congress approved it, and President Clinton signed it into law. Personal issues from Bill Clinton's past in Arkansas became part of his future as President of the United States. In the late 1970s, he and Hillary Clinton had invested in a land development company in Arkansas called Whitewater. Others involved with Whitewater were in legal trouble by the time Bill Clinton, a former governor of Arkansas, became president. A former judge who owned a savings and loan bank accused Clinton of pressuring him to make illegal loans to help the company. Clinton denied that. And there were questions and accusations about Hillary Clinton from the years when she worked as a lawyer in Little Rock, Arkansas. In January of 1994, after a year as president, Bill Clinton asked Attorney General Janet Reno to appoint an independent investigator. The Attorney General named a Republican, Robert Fisk, to look into the activities of the Clintons. But critics accused him of being too friendly to the administration. In August, three federal judges replaced him with another Republican lawyer, Kenneth Starr. Public opinion was divided about the situation. Some people thought the president and his wife were corrupt. Others thought any accusations of wrongdoing were nothing more than political attacks. Bill Clinton went on to win a second term in the elections in November of 1996. But new issues about his personal behavior would lead Republicans to try to remove him from office.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.